It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, what do chocolate, viruses, and penguins have to do with each other? Not much, but they're part of our monthly roundup of the latest science news with Gemma Tarlak of Discover Magazine. First, new findings from a Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism piece suggest the DNR may be facing pressures to put business and political interests in front of environmental concerns. Former DNR employees told a reporter that permits granted by the DNR were approved even though they failed to follow the agency's own conservation standards. The story centers around a permit granted to the Kohler Company, which has proposed building an 18-hole golf course on land adjacent to the Kohler-Andre State Park. Sarah Weitz-Kotacek is Wisconsin Public Radio's Mike Simonson Memorial Investigative Reporting Fellow and is working in the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism newsroom. Sarah, welcome to Central Time.
Glad to be here.
Well, give us the basics, first of all, about this plan for the Kohler Company to build this golf course on a site next to Kohler-Andre State Park.
Well, the Kohler Company is known for its bathroom fixtures and resorts and golf courses. And it has a piece of land, about 247 acres next to the state park that it owns. The company originally donated part of the state parkland in the 1930s, which is why it bears the Kohler name as well. Kohler wants to build an 18-hole public golf course on the shore of Lake Michigan on its land next to the state park.
And talk about the environmental concerns that people have raised along the way here.
Well, this property that Kohler owns has some of the rarest wetlands and dune formations in the state, and former DNR scientists who surveyed the property say that it's globally rare because some of these dune formations only exist in the Great Lakes region. They are host to some endangered species of plants and insects. The trees on the land, about half of which are slated to be removed for the golf course, house migrating birds on their ways across the Great Lakes. So environmental advocates and some former DNR staffers are concerned that the plan might inadvertently destroy some of these rare dunes, even if the company itself isn't going to touch them. Secondary impacts from fertilizer and runoff and nutrients entering those fragile ecosystems could still destroy these rare wetlands and dunes.
Right. So there's concern for the land itself that Kohler owns and wants to build on. Is there also concern that there would be, as you're just saying, that secondary impact on ecosystems within Kohler-Andre State Park itself, even though it wouldn't be built directly on? Is there a worry that there'd be a spillover effect?
Yes, there is. The property that Kohler owns has more pristine ecological systems than currently exist on the state park partly because of the human use of that park. And what remains in the Kohler-Andre State Park could potentially be affected by what happens on the Kohler property. At least that's the concern of some former DNR staffers and environmental advocates who have spoken up about this.
Now let's talk about those retired DNR officials that you talked to. What did they say about their review of this plan and what they heard from higher-ups in state government?
I spoke with Pat Truckle, who is a former wetland ecologist for the department, as well as other former department staffers, some of whom are in the story that we wrote, and several of whom did not want to be in the story, named in the story. But overall, what they said was that they are concerned that this permit does not meet the state standards for protecting rare wetlands, and that staff were pressured to approve the permit regardless of that.
And did I read it right? In one case, one of the approvals was made before an actual plan was submitted?
Well, it's unusual. What happened that these former staff say is unusual is that an environmental impact statement was done before a project application was submitted. And the statement was done by the department, which is not how it normally works. Normally, the applicant prepares the information for the statement and submits an application so that the department knows the details of the project that it is reviewing.
Talking to Sarah Weitz-Kotecheck, Wisconsin Public Radio's Mike Simonson Memorial Investigative Reporting Fellow, working with the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, looking at this effort by the Kohler Company to build a new golf course on land adjacent to Kohler-Andre State Park. Sarah, you talk about what the Kohler Company itself has said about this development and environmental concerns. What is their argument?
Well, the Kohler Company, although they did not they were not available for an interview for this story, gave us a statement and said that they are very conscientious about the environment and that they plan to avoid destruction to the rare wetlands. For the wetlands they are going to destroy as part of this, they will pursue wetland mitigation, which is a way to finance the creation and restoration of wetlands elsewhere. And they say that they plan to plant native species and avoid chemicals that would be destructive to the dunes and the ecosystem that's there.
You also talked to local residents in the area that would be affected. What was the range of things you heard from people who actually live and work in the area?
Well, we did sort of man-on-the-street interviews and ended up speaking with a landscaper who works for Kohler, who is all for this. He's helped construct their golf courses in the past and says, you know, what's the holdup? This is great for the regional economy. The company had a contractor do an estimate that they said that this would bring $21 million into the region annually and create hundreds of permanent jobs. Other residents, activists who have been involved in organizing and suing against the permit in this project, as well as the swap of some parkland for Kohler land to build a road and a clubhouse and a maintenance building, say that they're very concerned about the environmental potential damage, as well as some of the archaeological significance of this land, because there's over 25,000 historic and prehistoric artifacts that were discovered on the property, as well as a Native American burial mound. Kohler has said that they won't touch this burial mound and that it will be protected. So there's a range of reaction and perspectives on this issue, and it has stirred some local controversy. The golf course property was in the town of Wilson, and because residents there expressed some concerns about the project, the company worked with Sheboygan to annex the property, and then Wilson sued Sheboygan and lost. So this has, you know, there have been people with strong feelings on both sides of this issue locally.
On the wider issue of political influence in the DNR, when you talk to retired DNR officials, did they say this was a one-off case, or did they have concerns about a change in the way the DNR worked more generally?
I think that the retired DNR staff that I spoke with felt that this was a part of a somewhat recent shift in DNR, starting with the Meteor Timber case, where a timber company applied for a wetland permit to destroy wetlands to build a frack sand mine. And there were some very similar concerns. Pat Truckle herself was involved in the permit evaluation process for that and testified in a case that where an administrative law judge ruled against that permit. The DNR secretary has opted to review the judge's ruling, which is also a somewhat unprecedented move. So this is a part of, this is a pattern, perhaps the second instance of a pattern where DNR staff say they were pressured to approve permits that did not meet the standard of the law for wetland protection.
We'll leave it there for now. Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Sarah Weitz-Kotecheck, Wisconsin Public Radio's Mike Simonson Memorial Investigative Reporting Fellow. She joined us to talk about her piece about the Wisconsin DNR facing pressure to approve permits. You can read more at wisconsinwatch.org. Coming up, we'll get the latest science news with Gemma Tarlak of Discover Magazine. Spoiler alert, there's chocolate. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, wit can be hard to define, but we know it when we see it. We'll find out more with the author of the new book, Wit's End. Right now, it's time for our monthly check-in on the world of science. Researchers around the world are trying to predict and prevent the next massive disease pandemic using math and mapping. And new evidence shows that one of the world's most beloved treats, chocolate, has been around a lot longer than we thought. We'll talk about the origins of chocolate and how it shaped the world. Plus, penguins. Gemma Tarlak is the senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Gemma, welcome back to the show.
Hello, and happy science to you, my friend.
And to you too, Gemma. We'll get to the fun stuff, the chocolate and penguins. Let's start with our most serious thing today, this effort to get early detection systems for diseases. Talk about what's at stake here. If we could get an early warning of diseases, how much is that going to help?
Well, you know, potentially we as a species could be at stake. If you think about pandemics and just the devastation, you know, 100 years ago, the way the 1918 influenza pandemic devastated, millions of lives lost, it is possible that could happen again. And it's really surprising that for years you've had epidemiologists and a variety of other researchers working on the question from different angles, but there wasn't a lot of places they could go, really, to pool their information and kind of cross-check what they were finding out. And so there's this whole new movement, a multidisciplinary movement afoot, where they are pulling together their information and looking at the problem from different angles, as you mentioned, through math, through the use of an artificial intelligence that's learning how to predict outbreaks, and also from more sophisticated mapping techniques that have never been used to study the possibility of an outbreak in a particular area.
A really common source of human diseases is other animals giving us those diseases in virus form. And that, it looks like, is one of the ways researchers around the world are trying to collaborate here and look at, okay, what animals are likely to give us diseases? What viruses are they carrying? That's a lot to tackle. What kind of efforts are out there?
Well, for example, there's one group that is compiling a database. It's called the Enhanced Infectious Diseases Database, EID2. And basically, they're looking at which diseases are present in which animals and what are the chances that those diseases can move, say, from an animal to a human, a process called zoonosis. And that's one team. There's another researcher who is teaching artificial intelligence to learn how to figure out, okay, if this pathogen, if this bacteria or virus exists in this host animal naturally, why does it exist in that host animal? And what are the other animals that are at risk of the pathogen jumping into them? And it's very complicated. It's extremely complicated to go in and identify the traits that those animals share that may make it possible for a pathogen to jump from one host species to another. So it's a complicated process, but she's, again, teaching artificial intelligence how to learn it, and the algorithms are getting better and better at identifying the most likely suspects. So that's just two ways of looking at the host animal. There's another team that's looking at biodiversity, because the more diversity in wildlife and species present that an area has, the more likely you're going to find pathogens, and the more likely that different species will, you know, bump up against each other in some way, and that the pathogens will have a chance to jump from one host to another.
One other road that people are following, there are a lot of genome scans of different species and viruses out there. There are journal articles about them, but there's not, you know, if you're reading a big complicated book, you want that index to look stuff up. There's not really a solid index, it sounds like, where if I'm a researcher looking at a new disease, I want to compare and contrast. It's really hard to find this stuff.
Exactly, and that's one of the goals of the Enhanced Infectious Diseases Database that I mentioned, that they are really trying to compile all this information from all these different sources, looking at various aspects of both the host species and the pathogen itself. And one of the things I think is really interesting about this new effort is that there's a special mapping project underway, and this kind of thing has never really been done before, and it, when you hear it, you think, well, this makes sense, but no one has ever really gone in and found a way to map how an outbreak, once it's established, once people are getting infected and spreading a pathogen, how it spreads, and to identify the areas and the people most at risk for it to spread too, and to start hopefully preventive treatments, whether it be vaccines or quarantines or something. No one has ever really investigated how to do that on a super granular scale, kind of going block by block in a neighborhood, for example. And there's a whole new project with the British Red Cross and other groups underway to figure out, once a pathogen rears its ugly head, who is most at risk for kind of that second ring of infection and the third ring? How do we stop that spread once a pathogen shows up in a human population?
These are just a few of the methods that are in an article in Discover Magazine. It seems like the common thread is, hey, we're going to use big data and our power with modern computing to crunch that data to learn lessons that we would have been kind of guessing at just 20 years ago or so.
Exactly. Big data and artificial intelligence, and there's a lot of cross-pollination of different fields. You know, for example, biologists are working with mathematicians in a way they haven't worked with previously to kind of pool their different approaches and find the best way forward.
Talking to Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine, looking at some of the most intriguing stories from the world of science. Let's turn now, Gemma, to a favorite topic of yours, human prehistory, and a favorite topic of mine, chocolate. It turns out we humans have liked chocolate for a lot longer than we used to think.
Yeah, and what really fascinated me about this new research is that we find chocolate did not originate in Mexico or Central America. I think you hear a lot of talk, a lot of people say, oh, you know, I know people who do chocolate tourism, and they go to all these different stops in Mexico and Central America where they think that's the birthplace of chocolate. And it's actually, this new research, which was a multidisciplinary effort, found really the first evidence that chocolate originated in South America, that's where the cacao tree was first domesticated, that's where chocolate was first processed and eaten and, you know, I'm assuming enjoyed.
One thing I've learned, I think from you, Gemma, actually, is that if we want to find the birthplace of a species or a kind of plant, we want to go where there's the most genetic diversity, the most subspecies of it. And that was one of the clues here, right? The most different kinds of the original chocolate plant are in this part of South America.
Yeah, it's the upper Amazon basin, kind of the area that's now Ecuador and Peru, and there are more than 9 Theobroma species. It's Theobroma cacao is the specific domesticated plant, but there are other species, and also its wild ancestor is also most genetically rich in that particular area. So that's where they were able to confirm using ancient DNA that they found from plant residues on artifacts at archaeological sites. That's another way that they confirmed, yes, these people were domesticating Theobroma cacao and eating it.
When we think of chocolate around the world, we think of phrases sometimes like Dutch chocolate, Belgian chocolate, Swiss chocolate, that kind of thing. These are alien species, right, for the old world. These are newcomers to the cuisine of Europe, Asia, you name it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the Theobroma, the entire genus, definitely originated in the Americas, and based on the latest information, looks like it was in the north part of South America, this upper Amazon basin that we're talking about. That's where genetic diversity is richest for it. And so it looks like all signs are that it originated there. And then all, you know, we think of dark chocolate and milk chocolate. Those are all 19th century European inventions that happened way after chocolate was already long loved and very important to the Americas.
I want to take a few minutes now, Gemma, for penguins. You wrote a piece, just a kind of 20 things we didn't know about penguins. I want to touch on some of those. One, they're not around anymore, but there used to be 200-pound penguins in the wild.
Yes, there are a few species, such as Anthopornis and Kumamanu. They're extinct, so nobody worry about a giant penguin showing up at your door. But, yeah, they think they were 6 feet or taller and weighed about 200 pounds. Think of that. That's, you know, that's a lot of happy feet right there.
Fuel for all our penguin-related nightmares. Now, talk a little more. Why did you want to tackle the issue of penguins, Gemma?
Well, who doesn't love penguins? I mean, they're marvelous animals. And, you know, when I was in Antarctica, my favorite thing was to go watch the penguins. I lived down there for a while at McMurdo Station, and you could just spend your entire day sitting out there and just watching the penguins moving in and out of the water, sliding around on their bellies. They're adorable. They're fascinating. And I think they're kind of different than a lot of people think. A lot of people think all penguins are in Antarctica. That's not true. There are only two species that are exclusive to Antarctica. Most penguins live in places that don't even get snow, like Peru and South Africa. And so there are all these interesting facts that I think because of Happy Feet, because of March of the Penguins, because of all the pop culture penguins out there, that the true truth of penguins has been obscured.
Well, when we watch dinosaur movies and see the T-Rex in them, we don't watch and think, oh, there were penguins in the world at this time. But it looks like, yeah, there probably were.
Yeah, there may have been. We don't know because we don't have the fossils of the very earliest penguins. The earliest penguin fossils we do have, they're about 61 million years old. And what's really interesting is that there are a few different species of penguins already around at that time, 61 million years ago, which tells paleontologists that penguins as a thing were already established. And were already pretty diverse. There were several different kinds of penguins, and they were very different from each other. So that tells us that their roots, the very first penguins, go back further in time. And the latest estimates are 66 or 67 million years ago, and that's well within the time of T-Rex.
So I'm seeing a Jurassic Park sequel, Gemma.
With a 200-pound penguin?
With a 200-pound penguin chasing us around, yeah. All right. Well, Gemma, thank you so much. It's been a lot of fun, as always.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
That's Gemma Tarlak, senior editor at Discover Magazine. She's based in Waukesha, so is Discover Magazine. She joins us every month to highlight some cool stories in the world of science. Coming up after the news, who is the wittiest person you know? you can pick for yourself. I don't care. If it's not me, I hope it's me. We'll find out why wit is such an important part of being human, and feeling witty, oh so witty, can make us feel better or, feel really annoyed with someone else who thinks they're witty. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to The Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Northern California's so-called Camp Fire is now the deadliest and most destructive wildfire in state history. We get the latest on what's happening there and what we could do to prevent destructive wildfires. First, when you hear a pun, do you love it or groan out loud? Wit and wordplay have been part of how humans express themselves for probably as long as we've been humans. Or, as the cast of Monty Python once put it,
there is only one thing in the world worse than being witty, and that is not being witty.
James Geary is deputy curator of the Nieman Foundation for Journalism at Harvard and is the author of several books on words and language. His newest book comes out tomorrow. It's called Wit's End: What Wit Is, How It Works, and Why We Need It. James, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
Well, before I looked inside your book, I thought, it's going to be tough to write, essays and all this dry history of wit and so on and still have fun with it. That's not what you did. You went for kind of a show, don't tell approach. Talk about how you tackled, in a lot of different ways, wit.
Right. Well, I tried the dry explanatory approach first. And reading my early drafts of the book, I realized trying to explain wit was destroying it in the process. And I was really kind of panicking because I thought, how am I ever going to write a book about wit without destroying the joke? And my son is an actor, and he went to drama school, and I was talking to him one day on the phone, and he said he was watching Buster Keaton films for one of his classes. Buster Keaton, the famous silent comic, who's one of my all-time favorite wits and heroes. And our kids grew up watching Buster Keaton films. And I said, well, why don't you tell your teacher that I'm writing a book about wit, and I'd be happy to come and talk about Buster Keaton and wit and how it applies to acting. And to my shock and surprise, his teacher said yes. And while I was talking to the acting students about wit, that's when I had the idea, I need to make this book witty and not just about wit, but make it witty itself. And that's how I ended up writing each chapter in a style that matches a different kind of wit. So, for example, the chapter that's about verbal wit is written as a dramatic dialogue from a play, and that comes directly from that experience at my son's acting class. But there's also a chapter written in rap. There's a chapter about the neuroscience of wit, how wit might work in the brain, that's written like a scientific paper. there's a chapter about spiritual wit that's written as a sermon. There's a chapter on about the philosophy of jokes that's written in the voice of a guy at a bar telling jokes. And there's other chapters written in heroic couplets of Alexander Pope and all kinds of other different styles. And again, the style of each chapter is intended to match the kind of wit that I'm discussing in that chapter. So you're absolutely right. I try to show what wit is rather than tell about it.
But one thing that emerges in all these different styles is, I think if you asked me earlier, I might think, oh, wit, it's kind of a luxury of human language. It's an extra, it's kind of fun stuff. And the more different ways you look at it, no, it's kind of central to how we think and communicate.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's one of the key insights that I had as a result of writing the book is, I think we tend to think of witty people as stand-up comedians and like people like Robin Williams with a really special kind of gift for speaking and using verbal wit. But actually, wit is a kind of fundamental aspect of human intelligence and creativity. And we tend to think of wit as making jokes, but wit is really even deeper than that. It's about making connections. And you can make connections if you're an inventor, for example, or if you're a business innovator, an entrepreneur, a scientist, a visual artist, or someone like Buster Keaton, who never said a word on screen and is incredibly witty. And I think what I discovered as a result of writing the book is that wit is really a kind of intelligence, and it has to do with like perceiving and gathering information from lots of different sources and being able to synthesize those different information points into something new, into something fresh, into something innovative. So the kind of laugh you get from a punchline is the same kind of shock of recognition, surprise, delight that an inventor has when she makes a discovery, or a scientist has when she makes a discovery. So you have the ha-ha of the punchline, but you have the aha of discovery, and you also have the ah of like aesthetic experience, artistic experience. And I think those reactions are all prompted by different kinds of wit, which, like I said, is a kind of the operating system of human creativity.
I do admire the people who are really good at being quick-witted. Sometimes I think I'm really witty after the fact. I think I'm one of those people who, you know, the next day I have, or sometimes 3 years later, think of the hilarious thing to say. Can we cultivate that, I guess, quick-wittedness?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, there's a term for the affliction that you suffer, Rob. It's called l'esprit d'escalier. It's a French phrase from the French philosopher Denis Diderot. And what it means is the wit of the staircase. And it actually comes from an experience that he had. He was at a dinner party, and he was insulted by a guest. And he was so taken aback and flustered that he couldn't think of a proper response. And he only thought of a proper response when he was walking down the stairs on his way out and on his way home. And that's why he called it the wit of the staircase. And I think one way to kind of train your mind to be witty, and this may, I know, upset some listeners who think puns are the lowest form of wit, but making puns is a great way to keep your mind agile and limbered up. And again, making a pun is identifying two separate things. You know, a pun, two different words that sound alike, but they have separate meanings. And when you bring them together in a pun, you create that that reaction of surprise and delight. And that's basically the essence of true wit, the ability to hold in the mind two different ideas about the same thing at the same time. So when George Carlin, for example, said atheism is a non-profit institution, he was making a really funny pun about non-profit in the sense of religious seers and non-profit in the sense of not accepting any financial reward. So that's a kind of a very clever pun, but it's also a philosophical statement, a sort of critique about religions, which many of which claim to be non-profit, but are among the wealthiest institutions on earth. So I think a pun kind of re-energizes the mind precisely by making these surprising connections. And the more you do it, the easier it gets, and the more fun it gets.
James Geary is with us. His new book is called Wit's End, What Wit Is, How It Works, and Why We Need It. Well, funny you should mention puns, James. We did a show about puns about a year ago, and we recruited a couple of our WPR classical music hosts, Norman Gilliland and Stephanie Elkins, to record some. Here's a little listen.
What do you call a snobbish criminal walking down the stairs? A condescending condescending.
To the mathematician who invented zero, thanks for nothing.
I've accidentally swallowed some Scrabble tiles. My next trip to the bathroom could spell disaster. Oh my God.
Now, there's an extra level here, James, of our fairly dignified on-air personalities sharing these bad jokes and puns with us. That kind of adds to the fun, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And you know what? Those are amazingly good puns, by the way. I think what's interesting about a pun is that it not only makes you laugh, but it makes you think. And I think that's another characteristic of true wit. It's not just about the laugh, but it leaves a trail of thought, after it. And I think what you also see in puns, and this is true of jokes and witty remarks in general, is that the person who makes the pun, you know, thinks of that connection between Scrabble and a trip to the bathroom spelling disaster, for example. But the person who hears the pun has to make the identical connection. So the person who originates the pun and the person who understands the pun are actually performing the same intellectual creative work. They are figuring out the same connections. One is doing it in one direction and the listener is doing it in the other direction. But I think that's part of the joy of puns and wit in general, is that they challenge you. They challenge you to figure something out. They don't present you with everything kind of laid out and explained, but you have to do just as much creative work as the person who originates the pun or the joke. And I think that's why even listening to puns also kind of trains your mind to be more witty.
That's the joy of puns. I am someone who does tell a lot of puns, and yeah, sometimes people laugh, but sometimes friends, family, and coworkers, I'll get that sense, oh, this guy again. Why do we sometimes hate puns and those who share them?
I don't know. I think anything, if it's, I think we've all had the experience of someone who thinks he's witty and is perhaps not as witty as he thinks he is.
Yeah, that's me.
Or someone who, relentlessly, delivers puns and jokes and wisecracks and things like that. And so I think that may be part of it, because puns, like everything else, I think are best in moderation. But I also think that there's a fundamental misunderstanding about humor. And I think people tend to assume that if you're being funny, if you're being witty, you're not being serious. And I fundamentally disagree with that. I think witty people, even when they're being funny, are some of the most serious people around. In fact, to stick with the French, the French word for wit is spirituel. It means witty, but it also means spiritual, as in religion. And I think that's a great example of how wit combines the most lighthearted and the most serious aspects of human life. And to be able to have both of those things in your mind, you know, when you're in a situation, a crisis situation or an emergency, or you have to solve a problem, and you can make a witty, lighthearted remark, it shows that you're really engaging with the problem and you're thinking very broadly. And again, you're kind of processing lots of different information. And as you said at the top of the conversation, making a joke like that releases tension. It kind of gives people energy, intellectual and physical energy, and makes them feel, you know, up and is motivating. And I think that's why, you know, well-deployed wit and well-deployed puns can be really inspiring.
James Geary is with us talking about wit and why we appreciate witty people and comments so much. His latest book is out tomorrow. It's called Wit's End: What Wit Is, How It Works, and Why We Need It. And you can bear witness at 800-642-1234. Do you enjoy puns and plays on words? Do you make them yourself? Do you get the laugh and or groan? And who's the wittiest person you can think of in your circle of friends and family, or famous historical figures for that matter? Who do you look to as a source of great wit? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our conversation about wordplay and wit with James Geary. He's the author of the new book coming out tomorrow called Wit's End: What Wit Is, How It Works, and Why We Need It. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you appreciate a good pun? Do you maybe even have one to share? Are you the person who makes people laugh, groan, and think with your wordplay? And do you have a favorite source of wit? An author, a historical figure, a comedian, somebody you really appreciate their wit? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. And James, you wrote about, and in some ways wrote as, a number of different historical witty figures. Through this whole process, who, now that you've done this, who do you really respect and think, wow, they are really the pinnacle of wit in some ways?
Wow. Well, it's really hard to choose just one, but
you can pick more than one. Sure.
Well, I mentioned Buster Keaton. I just love Buster Keaton, and what I admire so much about him is he manages to be witty without ever saying a word, and the way that he plays with the laws of physics. And he's not using CGI. I mean, he made his films in the 19-teens and 20s, most of them. And the simplicity but ingeniousness of his wit, I think, is just incredible. And it never ceases to amaze me. Just a couple quick examples. He's in one of his short films, he's on a boat and his girlfriend falls overboard and he's rushing around trying to save her as she's drowning, and he gets a life preserver from the side of the ship, and he throws it into the water, and immediately the life preserver sinks. He comes home from work, he opens the door, goes into his apartment, takes out a piece of chalk from the pocket of his coat, he draws a hook on the wall, then takes off his coat and hangs his coat on the hook that he just drew. It's just these beautiful ways that he plays with how we see things and what we see. So I would say Buster Keaton is one of my all-time wittiest people.
Let's go to our callers now. Ethan is with us in Janesville. Ethan, I understand you have a pun or two for us.
Hi, nice to speak to you. Yeah, I work at the DNR here, and our forester is just loaded with puns. Seems to make quite a game out of it. He leaves me stumped more than to admit.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, as you can tell, it can go pretty far pretty fast.
Does he branch out into other areas of punning?
No, he mainly keeps it to trees, nuts, stumps, all things tree and forest.
All right. Well, quite a few oaks there to share, I'm sure, Ethan. Thank you so much for that.
Ooh, very good,
and
Rob.
I imagine a lot of, there are a lot of like specialty groups or insider groups that really go deep with their puns. James.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think people with a certain kind of specific knowledge, they can make puns that only someone else with that same set of information can understand. And that's why sometimes you see jokes from one culture don't really translate to another culture. And that's because to get a joke, you have to understand the context and the associations. And if you don't have the same set of associations, it can be hard to get the wit.
Ethan, thanks a lot for sharing that with us at 800-642-1234. There can be a dark side of wit, James. I mean, I think of people talk about Dorothy Parker and her circle, and a lot of them are like mean jibes. Hilarious, but mean. Or I played that clip of Monty Python doing Oscar Wilde and George Bernard Shaw trying to one-up each other with wit. Can it take kind of a mean turn?
Yeah, I think wit can be used as a weapon. In fact, the way that we talk about people who are witty, they have like a rapier wit, or they make a cutting remark. Those are all kind of metaphors that have to do with fencing. And wit can be a kind of, we also talk about the battle of wits. It can be like a fencing match with, people sparring and trying to get the sharpest stab at the most sensitive spot. And so I think, yeah, the way that wit can be deployed is as a kind of defensive mechanism. So you can be witty to distract from other types of feelings you may be experiencing. But yes, wit can be used as a weapon, and it can be used as a way to kind of humiliate or demean other people.
Talking to James Geary, author of Wits End, What Wit Is, How It Works, and Why We Need It. That book comes out tomorrow. James, you did one of your chapters is, as you said, a scientific essay on the neuroscience of wit. What happens in our brains when we hear that, say, that pun that makes us stop and think?
Well, there are... one theory is that there are two basic operating modes of the brain, the default network and the executive network. And the executive network kicks into gear when we're focused on a specific task, like we're trying to solve a problem, or we're trying to fix a car engine, or we're trying to do some mathematical equation. The default network is sort of the background operating mode of the human mind. And that's sort of like daydreaming, or when you're just kind of letting your mind wander, or sort of like the psychological equivalent of looking out the window of a train, and you're aware of all the things passing by. You're very aware of everything around you, but your attention is very diffuse, and it's not specified towards a specific task. And I think in that state, the default network of the brain, that's when we hear the various associations. So the guy who's making all the puns about trees and branches, and your great pun about oak. We hear all this, and because our attention is spread very, very wide, we pick up, oh yeah, that's also a reference to trees, and that's a reference to trees, and we wouldn't be able to pick up those different references if we were overly focused on one task. So when you're being witty, whether you're making a witty remark or hearing one, your attention is ranging very, very far in the mode of the default network.
Time for one more caller. Jeff is with us in Superior. And Jeff, I think you have a joke to share.
Yeah, isn't it ironic when a veterinarian has to go see a doctor because he has a hoarse voice?
Jeff, thanks. And there's so much. Is the English language particularly set up for puns, James, or does everybody get to share in this kind of fun? Because there's so many words. Homophones, is that what it is? The words that spell different sound the same. We have a lot of fun available to us briefly.
Yeah, we do. I mean, English is made up of, it's influenced by so many other languages. So we have more to choose from, but every language has those same kind of punning ability. And in fact, there's even a term for making a pun that's also puns on a word in another language, and it's called macaronic, the word where macaroni comes from. So you could say something like jokes about German sausage are the Wurst, and that's a macaronic pun because the worst in English and Wurst in German sound the same.
And the French president could tell macaronic puns as well.
You are good, Rob. You are good.
I try. I really psych myself up for this one. James, thank you so much. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
James Geary is a deputy curator of the Nieman Foundation for Journalism at Harvard. He's the author of several books on words and language. We've been talking about his new one. It's out tomorrow. It's called Wit's End: What Wit Is, How It Works, and Why We Need It. You can share your favorite pun, by the way, over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Share a pun or two while you're there, or share a great example, a writer, a speaker, a comedian who you think is just the wittiest one out there, your favorite source of wit. Again, that's over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. If you're a fan of drinking tea, you might have a favorite flavor. I don't always drink tea, but when I do, it's usually a straight-up English breakfast. I figure England knows its tea, right? Turns out England is getting a little bit out there when it comes to new tea flavors. An English grocery chain called Sainsbury's is releasing two new flavors just in time for Christmas. Tea flavor number one, pigs in blankets. Yeah, that's not like it's not like a different thing in English and America, and they mean pigs in blankets, the flavor of sausage and pancakes in tea form. At last. Now, that's nobody was thinking, I assume, that they needed it. But hold on, let's look at the ingredients. It's that the tea strain Lapsang Souchong, I apologize for the pronunciation, with sage and rosemary. That doesn't sound too bad as long as you're not thinking about, oh, and there's apple flavor in there too. So just don't think about the pancakes and sausage, you know, oh, it's hot ham water. No, just drink it for what it is. That could be okay. Flavor number two, it gets worse. Christmas Brussels sprouts tea bags. You might have heard Michelle in the background gagging at the very thought. Ingredients, green tea, a little bit of blackberry leaves, and yes, Brussels sprouts. And they're basically, I assume, just playing tea Mad Libs at that point. Like, insert a food name here. Okay, yeah, we'll make that happen. Brussels sprouts and tea. My dad always says, don't knock it till you try it. I will dissent. I knock it, I will not try it. But this is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.